I caught that moment of silence for the snow. See, everyone's boycotting.
Now, let me get this straight. You said this during the crosstalk with Steve Cochran. You're boycotting everything until the snow stops.
I am frosted, to say the least.
Right, well,
you know.
Well done.
Wendy, I don't want to disagree with you right away, but I wish it had snowed yesterday.
Because why?
Because the rain was worse.
You know what? It was miserable.
Wait, you're right.
Did you not get snow by you, Steve? Because I'm 8 minutes away from you, and we had a blizzard.
Well, we had a lot more rain than snow.
Yeah, and you know, you think had that rain been snow, we would still be shoveling.
Yeah, probably.
But I don't know. I guess you're right. All right. I don't like the rain more.
At least there's some romanticism to the snow.
I don't like the rain more. That's exactly the way to put it.
Plus, it gives you an excuse to just sit in the house and watch Netflix.
I have a puppy that I'm trying to house train, so I had to go out every hour in the rain with my hoodie on.
And then they come in the house and shake and oof.
I have taught the dog how to step onto a beach towel to wipe his feet, and then I wipe his back. So that is something we learned over the weekend.
That's progress.
We do that with the grand puppies all the time. We have two grand dogs, and that's what we do. Wipe them off with the beach towel, and then... Well, didn't work this time with the lab. He came in and shook all over my clean kitchen. So, thanks a lot.
I didn't think you were going to say shook.
Every time she says shook, I get scared.
What?
As I heard the beginning of shook, I went, oh, get ready.
It's the second time she did it already.
I
know. Be very careful, Mary. Please be very careful.
Put your hand on the button.
The snow. I was saying to Steve earlier, Steve and I were talking about the snow. I don't remember the last time an entire baseball series, the White Sox were supposed to play in Minnesota, all three games were colded or snowed out. The Cubs lost one of their games over the weekend here. I don't remember a time where a whole series was snowed out. That's been a while.
I don't know either. And I did see somebody post something on Facebook saying, oh, I can't believe it's snowing this late. And then all of a sudden I got this memory from 4 years ago where it snowed this late too.
It has in the past.
I just don't want it anymore.
Right.
Come on.
We've put in our time. Give us some sun.
I keep thinking of the scene from Terms of Endearment when Deborah Winger is in pain and dying and Shirley MacLaine is her mother and Deborah Winger can't get a shot, a painkiller until 2.
Yeah.
And Shirley MacLaine's running around the hall. You said 2 o'clock she could get... It's like, we made it. It's April. It's April 15th.
Right. Make it nice for us. Please.
Not as severe. Dave Edna wants to
just
jump in.
Just to clarify one point on the Minnesota series.
Yes, Dave.
The entire series was not wiped out. They did play on Thursday night.
Oh, they did, right. Right. I meant to say the weekend, your Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, but they did play Thursday. Okay. You're absolutely right.
Just don't want anyone to think that game didn't happen.
No, that game happened. Yes. You're right.
All right, thank you, Dave. The seasons are changing. Obviously, we get our summer now in July, and it goes to October, sometimes November. Mm-hmm. We need to change the baseball season.
So you would start and end the season, except...
I'd start later and end later.
If you'll remember... Like some of the series the last couple years when played in October, it's already pretty cold. So if you push
that over...
But
there are some 80-degree days in October, too.
But that's why they started the season this year on March 29th. They hoped that by moving it up a few days, that everybody start March 29th, that maybe they could end the postseason a little sooner and they wouldn't run into that problem.
Dave, are you of the belief Saturday's game was the Cubs game was one of the strangest events?
Is this the giant comeback that I hear everybody talking about?
Yeah, 9 runs on 3 hits.
Paul Sullivan called it a little league comeback.
It was insane.
I'm not a Cubs fan, but when I hear stories like this, I am pretty intrigued.
Ah, you couldn't believe what you were watching.
How much were they losing by?
They were down
10-2. And then 10-5 in the eighth inning.
And they came back and won it
14-10.
14-10.
How does that happen?
But think
everybody's
about this.
Hands were cold. They couldn't hold on.
And it really had the feel of a game that I've coached those games.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just
where you can't believe what you're seeing.
Because everybody's ready to go home.
I think too, Wendy, the Braves kept bringing in pitchers who weren't acclimated. They were better. They would have been better off leaving the guy in who couldn't find the strike zone. At least he was used to throwing in the cold.
Yep. 9 runs on 3 hits.
Good God, y'all.
To do the math on that.
I don't do math.
And one of the hits was to the catcher.
Right.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
It was a ground ball 15 feet down the line.
Yeah. It was crazy. All right. So, Dave, the question is this. Both teams, including Joe Maddon, said that we should not have played that game. You agree, don't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, you shouldn't be playing in those conditions.
Dangerous.
This game is not meant to be played in those conditions. I don't even know if it's so much a safety factor, but it's just, who wants to either play or sit and watch in those conditions?
Yeah.
I mean, I give credit to the people who stuck it out. I think there were an awful lot of people who might have showed up for the beginning of the game because they paid money for the tickets, didn't want to blow the money.
Right. John Williams.
He tweeted that he left in the third inning.
Oh, you baby!
Right,
I wasn't going to say that.
Well,
part,
he had
Dave.
Bucketball well, practice.
Yeah,
what is bucketball?
Right.
Could someone answer me that?
That's John's favorite game.
I know. Yeah. I hear it in the commercials. I hate to interrupt you. We can go back to bucketball. Back
all
to
right,
you, Dave.
You get a radio host on one side, and you get Teddy Roosevelt on the other, and they just throw balls in buckets. That's how you play.
Is it like an old-fashioned bushel that they cut the bottom out of?
I think it's a euphemism for basketball.
Well,
we think.
I don't like it.
But
he has to stop.
All right.
I brought
your don't like button to work today.
I did.
I think there were 1,000 people, somebody estimated, left in the ballpark during that Cubs rally.
Wow.
Which, I mean, I give credit to people who stuck it out. Just walking outside on Saturday was a character builder.
Yeah.
That's true.
There was a point in the eighth when there were a bunch of guys in one of the rooftops with their shirts off.
It had to be a bachelor party, right?
It was so fun by the end of it, though, from my living room.
Steve, the first time they showed that, there were about 9 guys with their shirts off, and then 10 minutes later, there was one guy looking sad and lonely.
The rest left.
Yeah,
it was a groom.
Even they wised up. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then there's a lot to discuss with you. Wendy is boycotting everything until the snow is over. How do you feel? We're at 312-981-7200, Bill and Wendy, WGN.
I like what they did there. Like a fast pass.
Yeah, like a fast pass. But not really, but kind of. But, yeah.
Are you a lit twit? We could have that, too.
That is the most hurtful thing you've ever said.
Oh, no. I didn't mean it hurtful or hateful.
No? All right, I'm right now.
I do mean this hurtful and hateful. Bucketball is not basketball, John Williams.
It's not? You sure?
I looked it up because I wanted to know where the crazy nickname for basketball came. I know you shoot buckets or whatever.
Shoot hoops.
Right.
Yeah.
Hoop ball. Why doesn't he call it that?
Hoop ball. Yeah, that sounds like fun.
Bucketball is the hottest new beach, poolside, and backyard game that's perfect for people of all ages. It takes the best parts of beer pong and cornhole and combines them into this wonderful new game called Bucketball. So is this what he's playing in a pseudo beach?
No, you know he's playing basketball.
I think he's playing basketball.
Who calls it Bucketball?
A lot of people call it Bucketball. We're going to shoot buckets.
Bucketball.
Yep.
We're going to go shoot some buckets.
Right.
Well, shooting buckets and Bucketball are two different things.
To the average person, if you say basketball, that doesn't sound cool. But as soon as you say buckets, boy, is that cool.
Did you just stop and listen to yourself?
No, I hear people like that all the time. For instance, what I'm wearing on my feet right now, I call shoes, but a teenager would never call them shoes. They're called kicks, and I go, no, they're shoes. I put them on, and they're shoes. I don't understand.
Who calls them kicks?
You've never heard a kid say that?
No.
Grab your kicks and go, let's go?
Oh, kids say that.
Wendy, kids?
Wendy.
It's my kids have never, ever said kicks ever in their entire life.
But I applaud them, because I don't play by those rules either.
Kicks? I never even heard anyone say that.
Yeah. There's like 1,000 of those where you just, it's like if you belong to a profession, you have inside code words so the people who work in a different profession don't know what you're talking about.
I know one.
What?
I heard Jimmy Mack say it this weekend. We were on North Central College in Naperville. Brandon Herman had a tribute to The Loop. You were invited.
Yeah.
It was hard to get out there.
Yeah.
Out in Naperville, WONC. And Jimmy Mack says to me, it's time for the interview. Put on your cans. I said, they are not called cans anymore. He was, of course, referring to headphones.
Right.
No one calls them cans anymore because I'm not even having cans. I got these little earbuds.
You're
wearing cans.
Yeah.
Nice cans.
But mine are literally cans. They're not headphones. I'm more comfortable with some Del Monte cans on my head.
I was going to say, I call them Del Montes, Bill.
Yeah, they're Del Montes. A friend of mine would never, ever, ever say car. He always said ride, and I called him out on it once. I go, you can say car. Just once in a while, just say car. No, it's a ride. It's a car.
I've heard that, but I'm telling you, kicks I never heard in my life.
Really?
I've heard I had my kicks on 66, and I have.
That means shoes.
But not for me.
That means
shoes. That meant something else.
I have to say this. Arlie Ermey died over the weekend. So most people would know him as the drill instructor from Full Metal Jacket. And if you've never seen Full Metal Jacket or
Why
his
not?
Scenes... Right. It's an amazing movie, a Stanley Kubrick movie that is so good, start to finish. And his character is just so intense. And I tried to get a clip of him doing the drill instructor, and Jasmine and I listened for about 15 minutes earlier. You can't go 3 seconds in a row. It's all swearing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's more swearing, Wendy, than you on a good day.
You told me I don't swear as much anymore, so you have to get some new material here.
Right.
I'll take whatever I can get.
So,
isn't that the weirdest name in television and movie history, though?
Arlie Ermey?
It seems backwards. It should be Ermey Arlie.
The way you say it, Bill, it's an initial, isn't it? R?
R. It's the letter R.
Right. But when you say it, you say it like it's Arlie.
Arlie Ermey. It's R period Lee?
Yeah.
No period?
I didn't know him that well. So I got to meet him a couple times.
You did?
Yeah. At WLS. And I know Ro will talk about this later on because they were extremely close. Every year we did a big Christmas show. And every year, the super surprise guests were Arlie Ermey and Dennis DeYoung. And I got to hang out with Arlie Ermey. Did I pause enough? I don't know if I did.
Yeah.
With R. R and I would sit down and we would talk. And I've never met a guy in my life who could be talking about anything, just regular and normal. And then something would happen. It would hit him. And he would get so angry and intense. And he'd be like that for like 2 or 3 minutes, and then back to sweet and pleasant again.
So like a storm, it would just roll through?
I've never seen anything like it before, and sometimes it was actually fun to watch, but I always had to like have my hands on the edges of my seat because you never knew when it was coming.
Like a roller coaster ride.
He would get so angry about something, and then just, yeah, everything's fine. You know,
that's called passion, I think.
I guess it is. Other roles you might want to see him in the Toy Story movies. You know, the army men that are in there?
He
does the voice of the army men.
Perfect casting.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting about him? He took this part in Full Metal Jacket. He wasn't supposed to play the drill instructor. His job was to coach the guy that was going to be the drill instructor. And then that guy couldn't come close to the intensity, the anger, the passion that guy had. And he ad-libbed much of it. When you watch it, yeah, there's a bunch of scenes where there's a guy he calls Gomer Pyle.
Yeah.
He's one of the soldiers, and Arlie Ermey's character keeps referring to him as Gomer Pyle. And you see him he can't stop smiling because to be berated that way, his only defense was to just smile during those scenes. But that was real. He was on the verge of cracking up, of laughing, because it was just so intense.
That I got scared watching it, didn't you?
It's so frightening. It was so frightening.
He's really good.
He also played in the TV show House, the great series about the doctor with problems. He played Gregory House's father in a handful of episodes over the years. He was really, really good in that. Very different role for him.
Only 74.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Was
that's
it pneumonia?
Not old
Is that what it was?
Yes.
It was something pneumonia related.
That's what
right?
I read.
I also have to say this, and please understand, I'm not saying this in a negative way. I've never met anybody whose eyebrows were so dominant that when talking to him, you couldn't stop looking at his eyebrows. It was like
Andy Rooney.
It was like if Martin Scorsese and Andy Rooney's eyebrows had a child. They would be Arlie Ermey's eyebrows. They were so overpowering and just so... Just anytime you talk to him, you almost had to purposely not look directly at his eyes because his eyebrows look like you know, gophers, like they could jump on you.
Well, they weren't furry. They were just...
Oh, no. I know you're looking at a picture of him, but when he was right next to you talking to him, his eyebrows were like 3D. They just came out and they reached out for you.
Bill does that trick anyway when you're talking. When you're talking, he doesn't look you in the eye, but he looks you at the space in between your eyebrows. You have a thing. You are secretly... You have an eyebrow fetish.
No,
yes,
I
you
don't.
Do.
But when something is that, did you ever see somebody with something's going on where you go, I'm not supposed to look at that. I'm not supposed to look at that. I have to look at that. His eyebrows were right there, and they were. Sometimes like he'd go, "Where's my wallet? Oh, wait a minute." He would reach in his eyebrow and he'd go, "Oh, there's my wallet. Where are my car keys? Hold on. Oh, there they are. They're in the other eyebrow there."
Jeez.
And then other people would say, "Boy, how about that guy's eyebrows?" Like other people would meet him. And they also, it's like, well, I've seen him in movies. I didn't know his eyebrows were like that. Oh, yeah, they are. They are.
I can't find the bushiness.
He got older, he just, you know, for a while he was hiring landscapers. And then at some point he just gave up.
Oh, is this more what you're talking
about? Yes. All right. You just found a picture. Yeah.
I'll send you the picture, Jasmine. We can, you know, put a little tribute to Army Early Army. Sounds like you're saying something wrong.
Arlie Ermy. That's his name.
Rest his soul.
Yes.
We'll do a tribute
to
his
eyebrows.
This is
why you and I aren't going to be asked to speak at his service. Just for this reason.
Why? You just wanted to hide in his eyebrows?
That's what I would talk. If they asked me to do the service, that's all I would talk about. I'd go, yeah, great actor, great military career. How about this guy's eyebrows? Did you see his eyebrows?
Very interesting.
Oh. Could rent out space. They were like corn mazes. I'm not making that up. All right, we'll take a quick break. We've got news coming up next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Steve, thanks very much. It's Bill Leffin and it's Wendy Snyder. Last night was the interview, the James Comey interview with George Stephanopoulos over on ABC that was extremely compelling. Very interesting hour of television. You did not get to see this, right?
I did not see it. I DVR'd it, but the night got away from me and then I had to watch The Walking Dead season finale.
At some point, sit down and watch. It's a quick hour. I don't know if there were any... Steve, would you say there were any major surprises last night? Did anything shock you that you saw or heard?
You know, I watched until the very end, and then most of the headlines came out of the very end when he called the president...
unfit.
Morally unfit.
Yeah.
To run or to hold the office, yeah.
Now, there was a distinction he made because he ended up saying morally unfit, but not mentally unfit. Right.
Right. He said people have talked about early onset and all of this stuff. He said, no, I don't see that. I think, you know, he follows conversations. He's aware of what's going on. He's not mentally unable to do it, but he's morally unfit to do it.
So when he said that, in my head, I kept trying to figure out if it would be more alarming, if one is more alarming than the other. I guess mentally unfit, because then
that
you
would
say,
be worse.
That's just a loose cannon who would do whatever he wanted to do. But morally unfit, I think more people, more people are willing to look the other way.
Well, they did. You know, Bill Clinton had some moral issues as well. So,
I know he did.
And, you know,
I know he did.
I know it's a role model. It's the top job in the, you know, United States. It is a role model. But, you know, some people in role model positions don't always have good morals.
Right. Well, okay. But this goes, I think what Comey's saying goes beyond Charles Barkley, you know, saying I'm not your role model. It goes toward speaking the truth and being true, using the truth to persuade voters rather than fabricating things and taking on the FBI. And, you know, I mean, the president, it's well documented, often is untruthful.
Didn't he
clearly
at some
untruthful.
Point, Steve, say he gave a couple of examples as to this moral unfitness? And one of them was he said he treats women like pieces of meat, you know, which has been alleged in the past. This wasn't the first time that came up. I found it fascinating, and again, this is a story that we had heard before, that Donald Trump was so obsessed with the amount of people who came to his inauguration that one of the meetings he had with James Comey is that was one of the only things he really wanted to talk about was the fact that there were so many more people at his inauguration than at Barack Obama's, and James Comey was sorting that out in his head going, but we know that's not true, you know, and Donald Trump has a way, you've heard this all before, of saying things to the point where you can prove it 1,000% that it's inaccurate, but he thinks, well, if I'm saying it, it must be true. I'm Donald Trump. I don't just say things. They're true.
But my question is, someone who acts like that is, in fact, insecure because they need constant reassuring.
Yeah.
But then he comes across as, you know, so confident. It's just a crazy dichotomy that's going on right now.
I know I've used this example before, but I think it is the perfect example to show his personality type. When I was working at another station, we had him on as a guest over the phone just to publicize The Apprentice. He wasn't running for office yet. He was just on The Apprentice. So when we gave the introduction for Mr. Trump, he pointed out that he currently has the number one show on television. So then I went to the computer, and there wasn't a single category that The Apprentice...
You're a thorn in everyone's side, aren't you?
Other than just shows called The Apprentice,
right?
There wasn't a single demographic, not one demographic, where that show was the number one show on television. But he insisted that it be known that because he was saying it, he was the host of the number one show on television.
And you tell me people listening didn't believe it?
I'm positive that
it's
enough.
It's like
people,
WWF, kind of. Is that what it even is anymore?
Yeah.
It's the best. I'm the best wrestler. I have the number one show. You hear it, you believe it.
Right. But I'm.
Did you call him on it?
No, but I'm going.
Call him now. Something. Jasmine, get him on the phone.
Jasmine, get Donald Trump on. I just want to ask him. But I think it sets a precedent, and we've seen him do this in the past where he just says something, goes, I'm saying it, or he'll always preface something and go, a lot of people are saying, but that doesn't mean it's true. A lot of what you can't end is, you know, a lot of people are saying this, a lot of people are saying that. That doesn't mean it's accurate. It just means people are saying it.
Well, and that's what I was trying to get to with the damage being done, you know, because he is saying things about the FBI and about other institutions that are, they're damaging,
right,
and they will be damaging long after he leaves office, whether it's 2 years from now or 6 years from now. The trust that some of these institutions have earned and deserve, he is tearing down,
yes,
by speaking things that are demonstrably untrue.
Right.
And that's what I mean about, it's more about whether you want your kids to grow up like the president. It's whether you have the damage you do morally that way. And I think that's the damage that we're going to have to overcome.
But once he chooses an adversary, once he chooses an enemy, and it can be the FBI or it can be the press, it could be anything, once he chooses something to go against, he wants everybody to go against. Here's something that I'm having a hard time with. I'm not seeing eye to eye with the FBI or with the press, or you pick your villain. And then he throws it out there as, so we should all not trust the FBI or the press, or you pick your villain.
Well, he, again, wants people to, you know, side with him.
Yeah.
So he's starting.
Yeah.
And Bill, he says something and his supporters believe him. They're still, to this day, you see so much misinformation. Somebody will retweet some story or
right,
post something on Facebook that's 100% not true.
Right, 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 right. But in a situation like James Comey described last night, where you've just been elected the president and you have a couple of minutes with the then director of the FBI, there are 1,000 things to talk about. You can't even imagine how many things there could be to discuss during those minutes. Why focus on the size of your inauguration crowd? That shouldn't even be an afterthought. That shouldn't even come up.
That doesn't surprise me in the least.
But that's all he wanted to talk
about. That's all he cares about.
Is how many people came and that it was the biggest.
It's that, you know, I have to prove to myself that it was a success.
Right, right.
You know, making history. Also, you know, this whole Syrian thing, and we will talk about it after 11, but, you know, just some tweeting that's going on and mission accomplished. And I remember a W character who said that as well when it wasn't. I don't feel using Twitter for serious things like this is the right way to do it. Why didn't he call a session where he could be televised and speak to the nation?
I don't know either.
He did that. He did that Friday night before the raids.
Well, there was a little bit of a warning saying it's coming.
Right.
And then there was a Pentagon briefing the next morning where they talked about, you know, what they knew from it so far. So that was done.
I guess it just...
Here's something else that you missed last night that I thought was significant. He didn't fire James Comey in person. James Comey was in an airport and saw it on a television, right, that he had been fired. And it's so ironic that a guy who kind of reached prominence by being on television firing people in person just doesn't seem to be able to do it as the president. Anytime anybody gets fired, it comes through other means. It's not your traditional, hey, come on in, sit down, I have to talk to you, you're fired. It's always done in a kind of a back alley way.
Because the television Donald Trump is different than the real Donald
Trump. I guess.
Even though people say he's not.
You can fire Vince Neil from Motley Crue, but you can't fire somebody, one of your staffers. Gary Busey, fire him all day.
Yeah, but they'll never come back to where he'll need them. Who cares about, I mean, sorry, Vince Neil and Gary Busey, but who cares about them? Donald Trump is never going to need them for anything again.
I guess.
Maybe Motley Crue tickets. I don't know.
Maybe. Also, one other quick thing from last night that I loved. George Stephanopoulos asked him about his family because he's got daughters that were big Hillary Clinton supporters, and his wife is a big Hillary Clinton supporter. And he talked about that because they went to the march. Remember the big march that was, it took place the day after the inauguration? They were all involved. All but I think one of the daughters were involved in the march and everything like that. And he kind of alluded to the fact that how did that play with the family? And I guess it didn't play too well, you know. As you can imagine,
yeah.
Because there's implications. The timing on his report, on his report into Hillary Clinton, came just before the election. And a lot of people, George Stephanopoulos called it beautifully. He said, there's a lot of people, a lot of your critics say that was a turning point. That was a huge difference.
And, you know, that's the thing. So when you have the president tweeting against James Comey for what he did, Comey probably did as much to elect Hillary Clinton
as anybody.
As anybody.
Right.
Well, what about at the tail end of that report about her investigation? That hurt her chances.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm sorry.
That's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, when he held that news conference in the summer, you know.
Oh, right, yes.
He cleared her. So clearly, if you think she should have indicted, that's a big one. Comey should have done something there. But then he holds a news conference. Usually when the FBI doesn't charge someone or prosecute someone, they just don't. They don't hold a news conference.
We don't hear about it.
Saying this person's despicable or, you know, was terrible with their secrets, which he said.
So he said that made him sick to his stomach because
why did he do it? I know he didn't want her to win and then all of a sudden say, why didn't you release this information? But they weren't going to do anything with it.
He said it would have been irresponsible to have not made that announcement that there was this investigation going on.
Talk about irresponsibility.
But I can't figure out. See, the way they pictured it last night was it seemed inconceivable. I mean, we have to remember back a year ago, it seemed inconceivable that it would play out that way. All the polls showed Hillary Clinton not just in the lead, but tremendously in the lead. Like, nothing can possibly go wrong.
This was after the Access Hollywood tape, you know, that was supposed to do in Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the polls, I just feel like his supporters lied just to... Because if people thought Hillary was going to win the election, they didn't go out to vote.
Well, I wonder going forward, and Steve, you're probably the best person to address to this. Next time we have a presidential election, all those pollsters that were wrong, and that's almost all of them. That's pretty much all of them. Do they carry any weight whatsoever after screwing up that badly last time? Will anybody believe those polls?
Well, we'll see. I mean, there were a lot of moving parts late in the campaign this time. I mean, you know, there was a real concern about Clinton fatigue and scandal and all of that. And she maybe had cleared it in July, but then when Jim Comey announced, was it 11 days before the election that they were reopening? I mean, that's a big thing for people who didn't want 8 years of investigations of the Clintons.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, he cleared her then 3 days before or something. So I can see how the polls might have been. It was a difficult polling time. But in answer to your question, pollsters make money getting people to pay for their polls.
Yeah.
So if there are campaigns or others who see that the polls were way off in November, they might be less likely to be hired as clients in the future.
Interesting.
What was the meeting like between Hillary and James Comey when they got together? Did she knee him somewhere? Because really...
Did that come up, Steve? I'm trying to remember if that even came up.
Have they gotten together? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know that happened. I mean, what would you even say to him?
That's the weirdest thing that, you know, the president makes the case that Comey is conspiring against him, but really Comey...
helped him.
Really helped him.
A lot.
And McCabe, the thing McCabe was fired for, was leaking an anti-Clinton story.
Yeah.
It wasn't leaking anything against Donald Trump. It was helping Donald Trump. And so then you have... President Trump tweeting about lying McCabe and all of that stuff. That's all over a story that damaged the Clintons.
How would she have run the country since she was going to be locked up? That's what I want to know.
Well, that was the argument they were trying to make.
I said it to be funny.
Right. It's not funny.
It's not funny. Nothing's funny.
All right. More discussion in just a little bit.
It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. It's WGN Radio. And we were talking about the James Comey interview last night. And we were talking about the election. And we were talking about a lot of things. And some texts have come in. 312-981-7200. Someone said the pollsters did not screw up. There were many voters that wouldn't acknowledge that they were actually voting for Trump. I voted for Trump, but I wasn't one of the people that put the knowledge that he was best. So if that's what I mean, people lied to pollsters. They a lot of people didn't want to admit that they were voting for Donald Trump. So they would just say, oh, I'm voting for Hillary. And if Hillary supporters thought she had it in the bag because all these pollsters said, oh, my God, you told me there was no way that Donald Trump was going to win.
I couldn't imagine. I don't remember a single poll, not one poll that had Donald Trump in the lead. Her lead was somewhere between 12 and 14%, which is so substantial. That's so huge. Everybody was shocked. Everyone shocked with this. But I think it does delegitimize any company that makes their money presenting accurate poll results, because if what this woman says, this texter says, is true, and why wouldn't it be? It just shows how easily they can be fooled.
And I'm surprised it took this long for them to be fooled. I mean, I guess you have
it
nothing.
It probably happened in the past too, but it's never the numbers have never
extreme.
Come out like this.
I mean, if somebody called you randomly and said, "Who are you voting for?" I don't know. I wouldn't lie because there's no reason to.
Right.
But some people might, and I just know between family members, there were people that voted in friends and family that I know. There were people in the family that voted for Donald Trump, but didn't say that they were voting for Donald Trump
just to avoid any conflict.
Yeah.
I guess. Another highlight, and I know you haven't seen the interview, but if you get a chance, there's certain moments of it that are so good. One of them is James Comey telling the story about right after Donald Trump won the election, there's a gathering in the Oval Office, and he's invited to it. And he said he wanted to remain inconspicuous, which is very hard because he's gigantic. He's like 6'8".
He's a tall drink of water.
It's amazing. There was a scene last night where they showed him get on an elevator with like four or five other guys. And he's not just taller than them. He's so much taller. So for him to say, I just wanted to remain inconspicuous at this meeting. And he's wearing a blazer that's the same shade of blue as the drapery. So he tells the story and then they
so
show it.
So he'll blend in?
He moves toward the drapery so that he said, I just wanted to blend in. I didn't want to. And then Donald Trump singles him out and thanks him. And he comes over for a handshake. And he's got this look on his face that is called his oh no look. But his wife called it something that got bleeped out. It's oh no, you know, as he's walking over to Donald Trump. And it appears that Donald Trump gives him a kiss on the cheek. Just because of the angle of the cameras, Trump comes over and you can't see what goes on, but it looks like Donald Trump is kissing him on the cheek. And he said, I know America saw Donald Trump kiss me on the cheek, but he didn't. He just whispered to him, you know.
It was like Judas giving Jesus a kiss before he betrayed him.
In the Oval Office.
Someone else has texted, no one calls Trump out to his face, so the lies continue unchallenged. And there is some truth to that. I know you have Sarah Huckabee Sanders, or Sanders Huckabee, that is out there dealing with it. But face-to-face, who is really challenging Donald Trump?
So do you think part of the reason he doesn't fire any of these people in person is he knows there's going to be a horrible moment where somebody goes, well, you fired me, I might as well let loose, and just gives him, Donald Trump, a piece of their mind and just goes, you know, you make up the story, but they just, you know, they go, all right, as long as I'm fired, I'm going to tell you how I really feel. And he wants to avoid that?
I don't know.
I don't know that he's fired. Like, all these names that we've seen get let go
in
the last
year.
Yeah, a
lot of them.
I don't know that there's been a single time where he has sat down with them in person and fired them in person. It's always done through other means.
I don't know. This is why I could never be a world leader. I would not fire anyone because I would be afraid of what they tell people about me.
Right.
You know, keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
Yeah.
He's firing everybody. I mean, why don't they all put out a greatest hits album of what's going on?
It may happen. All right. We'll take a break. We'll get some news next. Steve with the news. And then Tom Mikaitis joins us, a terrorism expert, to go over what's been going on in Syria the past couple of days. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Thank you, Steve. I have a couple of questions, and hopefully we are going to get a guest on. Tom Mikaitis is a terrorist expert. He's a professor. I don't remember where.
I think the University of Chicago. I'm almost positive.
At DePaul.
Like I said, I'm positive it's DePaul. A lot of there's been some misconceptions that he's at University of Chicago. No, DePaul.
This whole Syrian airstrike situation that happened over the weekend, the timing was suspect to me, that it's happening on a Friday. Like, you remember Wag the Dog, you know, sometimes I think maybe it would be best if this was in the news cycle, but when something happens on the weekend, everyone has told me it's to bury it.
Yeah.
Is that true?
It seems to be. The timing is strange. Also, with fresh allegations about Donald Trump, there was some conjecture that maybe possibly it was a diversionary tactic. We'll ask Tom Mikaitis because I don't know the answer to any of those things.
All right. Well, we are trying to get him right now. It was also confusing to me that Russia was not 100% behind these strikes and that there are some people who are saying this was an act of aggression, and yet some of our allies obviously worked with us and said, no, this is something that had to be done. Mission accomplished. Not really. Isn't this just kind of a warning to say, listen, we know that you're using chemical warfare and we're not going to put up with this. Mm-hmm. But now the Russians are saying that they examined the area and there was no chemical warfare. This seems all crazy to me.
The part that's most disturbing, well, there's a lot of disturbing parts, but this part that scares me the most was Vladimir Putin the day after it happened. So this would be late Saturday into Sunday, was saying that if this was to happen again, if there are more strikes from our part of the world, there will be global chaos, which is not a phrase I want to hear from Vladimir Putin.
Okay, and see, that's, I guess, where my big question lies, is my 15-year-old son said, should we be worried about the Syria thing?
Yes.
And I said, yes, but I mean, and then other people are saying, oh, this is the beginning of World War III. Is it?
Well, hopefully not.
But I mean,
but you
I mean,
know
I'm
where
a little more afraid of Korea.
Again, with good reason. Yeah, neither of them are the kind of things you could just slough off. Although, the story, as big as the story is, seems to have almost already evaporated, and I don't know why.
I don't understand that either. So, again, we are in the process of tracking down Tom Mikaitis. He's professor of history at DePaul University. He is a terrorism expert, and there is definitely terrorism involved in this because the people of Syria, I mean, I can't stand to see the footage of those children and being hosed down and washed down.
Well, this is a tricky one.
We do have
Tom. All right.
We have so many questions, and really the only guy that can answer them is professor of history at DePaul, Tom Mikaitis. Tom, we were filling a little time as we tried to locate you. First of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Well, we're confused. Just, you know, the airstrikes that happened in Syria on Friday seem to be buried over the weekend. It seems to be that Russia said there wasn't any chemical weapons and they are not behind this at all, yet our allies are with us. What do you have to say about this?
Well, this is a largely symbolic gesture. I suspect they were chemical weapons facilities. I don't believe we got all of them. And the most tragic thing to me is it will make absolutely no difference in terms of the killing. I mean, I find it bitterly ironic that there have been about 500,000 Syrians killed in this god-awful war. And we're up in arms over 43 who died in one chemical weapons attack. Assad has plenty of ways to kill people. He really doesn't need to use chlorine, and it's not even all that effective a weapon.
Will this amp up his numbers? Will he kill more because of this?
No, he'll just keep on keeping on. This civil war is the tipping point is long since over. He's going to regain control of most, if not all, of his territory, and we have pretty much signaled to him that we are not going to interfere with that. And as long as he has Russian and Iranian backing, he doesn't really have to worry. And these strikes actually really far from demonstrating our power, demonstrate our limitations, because we carefully avoiding hitting any place where the Russians were. We made very clear that we weren't going to remove him. We gave him a week to move his equipment to safer places. I mean, in some ways, if it weren't so tragic, it would be comical.
Explain that tactic to us just a little bit, Tom. When you come out and say, hey, we're about to create these airstrikes, who comes up with that rule? And what's the plus and the negative to that rule?
Well, the rule is the president likes to have daily tweets, and despite the frustration of those around him that they wish he would stop, he continues to do it. There is something called deconflicting the airspace over Syria, which is an elaborate way of saying we are in communication with the Russians to prevent an accidental encounter over a very crowded airspace because we don't want to engage them or escalate the situation. But all that means then is that Assad got a clear warning that he can move whatever assets he could to bases where there was Russian presence and there was Russian air defense capability and that those assets would be protected.
And we believe that was done, right?
Oh, we have clear evidence of it. There was reports of it all last week.
But see, now I have to read this text because I read it and now it's in my head. Numbskulls, it's not World War III, Syria bombing buried in the news because Trump did the right thing and the media cannot give him credit. Well, here's where I'm thinking and everything. Yeah. I never used to be a conspiracy theorist, but now I feel like I'm getting to be that way. You know, we think that a lot of people think that Trump is in cahoots with Vladimir Putin. But now it's if we're going against him, it's like he has nothing to lose and everything to gain by showing the American public, look at, I'm not in cahoots with him. I'm gonna hit Syria with airstrikes.
What? Well, yeah, I'm not saying he's in cahoots with Putin. I don't think there was any coordination of where they were going to hit. I think this was done entirely by the Pentagon, who actually restrained him. It's not about giving him credit. It's about the absence of a serious strategy. Now, to be perfectly fair, we can go all the way back to the Obama administration and say there was not much of a clear strategy there either. That essentially, you know, we don't really have a plan except to let this thing burn itself out. And I guess what frustrates me most is this high-handed talk about how moral we're being by hitting chemical weapons facilities when we allow the killing to keep going on. Every strategist said nothing short of a sustained air campaign would put any pressure on him. We're not willing to do that. There's no will for ground troops, and I would be opposed to that anyway. So it's not about blaming or giving credit. It's about trying to say, where is there a strategy that is going to try and bring this conflict to a conclusion?
Tom, if the White House called and said, Tom Mikaitis, you solve this. We don't know what to do. We trust you. How would you solve this?
Well, direct negotiations with the Russians and Assad, and if you're going to hit his targets, you hit things that are relevant to him, like his palaces, his assets, and you keep that pressure up and steady and so on. But there are risks involved in that. And quite honestly, if I were asked, I'd say, I wish you had called me 3 years ago. We have no good options. And the other thing to remember, too, is there are so many players here. There's no one really in a position to step into the power vacuum. If we completely destroy his regime, you're going to have a fragmented state, which is very problematic in terms of regional security.
Should Barack Obama have done something involving Syria, as you mentioned, 3 years ago?
I'm inclined to think he probably should have. I don't know that simply, you know, random airstrikes would have worked. Clearly, this, you know, game of saying, well, you know, I promise I won't use them. I promise I'll have them destroyed didn't work. To be fair to him, Americans had it with interventions in the Middle East. But I think, you know, now we're seeing that, you know, the cost of this is high, and the time to intervene, if we were going to do it, was before the Russians became so directly involved in supporting the Assad regime.
Are you okay to stick around for a little bit, Tom? You're okay time-wise?
Sure, I'm fine.
Okay, Tom Mikaitis is our guest. If you have any questions or comments, we're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder. Our guest is Tom Mikaitis. Tom is a terrorism expert, professor of history at DePaul University. Here's what's getting lost in the shuffle just a little bit, Tom, in my opinion anyway. Vladimir Putin said that if there's another strike from the Western world, there will be global chaos. Those are very scary words to me. Should I be scared?
No.
No?
This is part of the war words and part of the ratcheting up of the rhetoric, but we were very, very careful not to tread on Putin's toes. The Russians didn't even engage their air defense systems over Syria. They didn't even fire anything, and they didn't need to, because it was made clear to them in some fashion that we were not going to do anything that would endanger their military assets in the region or their personnel. As long as that's the case, then we're dealing with Cold War-style brinkmanship here. This has really become something of a proxy war like we used to have 50 years ago. So unfortunately, you've got, you know, not just two, a number of leaders in the world who engage in this kind of, you know, bravado and this kind of rhetoric, which isn't very helpful. I don't expect to see chaos. I mean, they might ramp up their cyber attacks. They might stir the pot other places. I'm not looking to see a direct confrontation between U.S. and Russian forces.
This is strictly posturing, in your opinion.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of maneuvering in terms of, you know, of economic sanctions and expelling diplomats and things like that. But I'm not seeing anything that is cause for concern. I mean, you know, provocation goes on a daily basis. I don't know if people realize that, but there are a number of incidents in the Baltic and various other places of Russian planes doing very close flybys to American ships, American aircraft. You know, kind of intruding briefly into NATO airspace. This is an ongoing sort of thing. And so far, there's a pretty strong desire on both parties, on the part of both parties, to not let this get out of control.
And there have been issues in Syria in the past, and you're right. It just seems like this latest chemical weapons attack, we saw it. So then it's all of a sudden we have to do something about it. Younger people in my family saying, why are we involved? Why are we involved? I didn't really know what to answer my kids when they asked me that.
Well, we've always had a long-term interest in regional stability, both for economic, political interests, and so on. But essentially, you know, we sowed the dragon's teeth when we invaded Iraq. I mean, ironically, Iraqis are out in the streets demonstrating against these air attacks because they're seeing the consequences on a daily basis of what an intervention is, and the bitter irony of mission accomplished being repeated by this commander-in-chief, as George W. Bush said in 2003, is an indication of, you know, these things have long-term ripple effects. So right now, our primary strategic objective is to destroy the Islamic State. And that's what we're saying, narrowly focused on. That's not going to make these other problems go away, much as it's a desirable goal.
Tom, a couple of texters asking different versions of the same question. What's in it for Russia to support Syria? What are they getting out of this?
They have a base on the Mediterranean there. They want regional hegemony. But to a significant degree, you know, wounded Russian pride is really not an insignificant factor. This was Vladimir Putin has said that the collapse of the Soviet Empire was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. And if you listen to some of the rhetoric during the Russian election and people saying, well, I'm proud to be Russian again. You know, people, you have to take us seriously. You have to pay attention to us. There's not a little bit of ego and national pride that is driving some of this behavior.
Another thing, again, conflicting reports, and I don't know who to believe anymore. The U.S., saying there were three targets that, and we hit all of them. And there are other reports from elsewhere saying that our missiles were shot down. Who do we believe? What happened?
Well, all the evidence is that the missiles hit their targets. Because we're now into the spin doctoring. The Syrian media is trying to, and the Russians are trying to say it was an ineffective attack, didn't do much damage, etc. The Syrians don't have the capability to shoot down the precision-guided ordnance that we fired into their territory. The Russians engaged, their air defense systems might have been different. So I think it's the Pentagon briefs on that regard are I think, quite credible and quite believable. The degree of damage, the degree of crippling of the weapons program is much harder to determine, and that's going to be based on, you know, on a damage assessment after the fact, and I don't even know if that material is available yet. What I can tell you is this will have no effect on Assad's ability to wage a war and win the civil conflict and reconsolidate power.
Donald Trump has alluded to a sit-down meeting with Vladimir Putin. Is that realistic, and is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, sit-down meetings are always preferable to throwing missiles at one another, but I don't think it's very likely. And this last round of confrontation isn't going to make it more likely. I think there has to be a lot of back channel negotiations and a turning down of the intense rhetoric before anything like that is even conceivable. So I don't expect it to happen. And I don't know that you accomplish much in those kinds of talks unless the groundwork is very carefully laid beforehand.
What's going on with North Korea? While we have you, we may as well ask you.
I was going to say, it's a good day to be Kim Jong-un, right? Nobody's paying it. Right. Maybe it's not. It's a good day you're not being paid attention to, so maybe he'll stir the pot next. That seems to have quieted down, and cooler heads appear to be prevailing. I think the Olympics was a real balm on the whole thing. Even if their joint hockey team didn't do very well, that doesn't really matter. So it seems as though that cooler heads are prevailing there. Possibly China's exercising some influence on him. He took that quick trip to Beijing, and since then we have not heard a lot of saber rattling, which I'm encouraged by.
I swear to God, you're the human Prozac. You really make me feel better every time we speak to
Put
you.
Put that on your resume, well, Tom.
If you had talked to me Friday night, I think you would have gotten a much smaller dose because it was pretty discouraging to see what was going on. But, you know, we've been through darker times and we just got to keep on keeping on. I feel what I'm really torn by is just the tremendous human suffering in the region. And, you know, we're going to have a refugee problem we're going to be dealing with for decades after this, as well as the political fallout.
If you had to make a list of who our most dangerous threat is right now, would it be Kim Jong-un? Would it be Assad? Would it be Putin? Who would it be?
Assad's not a threat to us. He's an entirely regional player. I think Kim Jong-un is a concern in terms of the situation escalating. The danger with Putin is that with all this posturing, maneuvering, and bravado, that you could have an accidental encounter getting out of control. But, you know, I mean, if you look at long-term concerns, as I'm looking out at winter in April, I think climate change, rising sea levels, global pandemics keep me up at night much more than a lot of the stuff we end up talking about on the news.
A texter wants to know, if Donald Trump has so much concern for the people of Syria, why are we not accepting more refugees? What are your thoughts on that?
That's a valid point as well. You know, we're not accepting refugees from very many places at all. And that's part another reason why getting on the moral high, claiming we have the moral high ground here is sort of bitterly ironic. You know, I don't think there's any risk of taking Syrian refugees. I think we should take more of them. I don't expect that to happen.
But we're told that if we bring in refugees, there's a chance that they could be terrorism cells coming in disguised as refugees. Is that even a credible idea or not?
It's in theory possible. It is not a high risk thing. The evidence, and I've done a lot of work on this, I'm actually working on a project on this now, is that the evidence is that the radicals that are, first of all, often one generation 1.5 or 2.0, the people that are born here or came here as small children. And a study out of the University of Chicago showed that the perpetrators or the people they've arrested are not refugees. So I think that's such a small risk, it's really not, shouldn't be factored into policy considerations at all.
And finally, you said, you know, Assad will just continue to do this because he does what he does. What's next if he continues? What is our goal next?
And basically, if malign neglect, we're just going to put a fence around it and let it burn itself out. I mean, you know, it's horrible to die exposed to chlorine gas. We saw that as far back as World War One, but is it any less so to be, you know, to take shrapnel from a barrel bomb if you're a child and die in agony over a matter of days? Which has happened. You know, hospitals have been hit, neighborhoods have been hit, areas have been starved out. He has plenty of ways to kill each other, you know, to kill people that he doesn't particularly like or whose territory he wants to reclaim control of. It's like having a quiver with 20 arrows and taking one arrow away and saying the person's no longer dangerous.
It's pretty scary. We thank you very much for making some sense out of this, what is to be had. Tom Mikaitis, professor of history at DePaul University. How do we get in touch with you or listeners who want to follow you on Twitter or other social media?
Yeah, Twitter is at Dr. Mikaitis, and I've got a WordPress page as well. You just Google my name, it'll pop up pretty quickly. I put blog posts there fairly regularly, commenting on things and so on.
Let's spell your name.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's not the traditional spelling of Mikaitis.
T-O-M. Am I getting this right, Tom? T-O-M?
Yeah, that's you got that one. That's
all right. That one's good. MOCKAITIS. Tom Mikaitis, professor at of history over at DePaul University and an expert on terrorism. Tom, we appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Sure. You guys have a nice day.
We'll take a quick break. We'll get you some news, and then Eric Zorn of the Chicago Tribune joins us. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Zorn, 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 the greatest father in all the land. Zorn, 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 we sing the praises of Zorn.
Oh, I love the lute. Don't you?
On the lute.
On the lute. Is there any more beautiful instrument than the lute?
Wasn't that? It was a Chicago radio station, wasn't it?
Yeah,
the lute. The lute FM?
All lute music all the time.
I'm wearing my lute shirt today.
Eric Zorn joins us. Fine, fine columnist for your Chicago Tribune.
I'm the greatest father that ever was born.
Greatest father that was ever born.
We might have to change that.
I don't know why.
If you wouldn't mind, Eric, the Rod Blagojevich story has taken another twist in the last couple of
hours. Why won't anyone give him the get-out-of-jail free card?
Or you might better say it didn't take another twist. The Supreme Court rejected his what really has to amount to his final appeal to overturn his convictions. Basically, they wanted the court to look at the laws under which he was convicted and say these are too confusing, this is not right.
He's in there for too long of a sentence.
The convictions are based on an understanding of bribery and official misconduct that his lawyers think, and some people argue, are first of all inconsistent and also are too, you have a system in politics that's kind of greasy anyway, right? People are giving money, expecting favors, and so on. Blagojevich crossed way over that line in when he was soliciting contributions for official actions. But the question was, did he actually cross the line? Should that line be moved? And then the question that you raise, Wendy, which I think is a better one, which is his sentence way too long? And it's 14 years.
He served five out of the 14?
He served about half, I think.
Oh, is it that much?
Yeah. When did he go in? We could probably look this up. But it was right around this time, like I said, I think like 5, 6, 7 years ago, something like that. It was a long time. I feel really bad for his kids, his daughters. His daughters just completely don't deserve this. They lost their father. I blame him for a lot of that. I think that 14 years is too long.
But can't you say that, what you just said, can't you say that about almost anybody who's ever committed any crime?
Yes,
their family is going to be without that man or woman.
Yeah, but some crimes are way worse than others, obviously.
Without a doubt.
Well, this was a major betrayal of the public trust that he engaged in. I was certainly thought that his conviction was justified and satisfying.
He's going to be released in 2024.
And his daughters are going to they're going to be grown up. And in the Chicago Magazine article from it was about a year ago, apparently his relationship with them is very strained because of this. And it's very difficult to talk to him and so on. You're right. Any criminal commits crime. It's part of the price of crime is that you're going to harm not just yourself but your family. It's something people should think about before they commit crimes. That you're not the only victim if you're caught.
Yeah.
But I guess the question is, you look at George Ryan's sentence, which was, I think, 6.5 years, and he served, I don't know, 5 of it or something like that.
But they also, with George Ryan, kept saying, this is hard on his wife. She's been sick and stuff. We should really get him out early so he can spend time with his wife.
She died. Yeah, she did.
She died while he was in prison.
Yeah. He got to go to the funeral.
Dan Webb, his attorney, was saying, Your Honor, a 6-year sentence is a death sentence for Mr. Ryan because he's so ill. Well,
see, he's still around?
He's still alive, yeah. This is a typical thing that an attorney will say. I feel, as a citizen of Illinois, I feel satisfied by the amount of time that that former Governor Blagojevich has served in prison. I'll be annoyed beyond words when he gets out and starts chirping about his innocence and how unfair this all was. I've said to people before, saying if he would just take a deal that he will get out of prison and he'll move to Omaha and not say another word, I'll be just.
You would be okay.
2011, he went in.
2011, so we're talking 7 years then.
Wow.
7 years ago, and it was this month, right? Or last month? It wasn't. It was springtime.
I don't know the answer to that. What about this, though? So, we live in a world where if you're famous, they tend to be a little more lenient on your sentences, oftentimes not convicting the person whatsoever if you have a little bit of name recognition, facial recognition. With Rod Blagojevich, it almost worked against him, didn't it?
Well, one of the things that he did wrong, or the mistake that he made, was going and campaigning for himself in New York, going on all these TV shows, yeah, talking about how unfair this was and how innocent he was and how mean the prosecutors were.
That was bad.
It was just really poor public relations. If he had, after he was arrested, said, you know, okay, busted, you got me here, let's talk, he'd be out by now. He'd have been out
people
years
forgive
ago.
You when you admit to making a mistake, don't they?
They do,
more so than lying.
And I think he had the opportunity to cut himself a deal and did not take it. And so, you know, he decided he was going to fight the feds, and it was a really bad idea. Patrick Fitzgerald had like a 90% conviction rate, and with those tapes all arrayed against him, it just wasn't a smart bet. He lost the first trial. I don't know if after the, or I'm sorry, he didn't lose the first trial. The first trial was hung. Remember, the one juror wouldn't vote to convict, so they had to go back and do the second trial. I don't know that he had a chance between trials to cut a deal. I expect that he did. The government is almost always trying to offer people deals so they don't have to go through the bother of a trial.
Help me with this, because I don't remember the exact way this played out. Didn't Donald Trump take a liking to him and invite him to be on The Apprentice, and then his wife filled in for him? Didn't that happen?
He was on Celebrity Apprentice.
He was on that?
Yes, he was.
His wife did I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Remember that show
that
where they had to eat bugs and stuff?
All right, so there's some relationship between Donald Trump and Rod Blagojevich. Could the president just throw a pardon?
It's a federal conviction. Yes, the president can throw a conviction. Well,
no,
he's in a pardoning frame of mind. You know, he pardoned Scooter Libby the other day.
Can you just pardon any time? Usually it's at the end of your term.
A president can pardon on federal charges anytime. He can't get into, you know, state convictions and so on. But
what about traffic court?
On federal charges. Yes, and I know I've written to him so many times. No, any federal charges. Donald Trump tomorrow could pardon or, you know, commute the sentence.
Wouldn't that be crazy?
More like unfired.
I
could see him commuting the sentence because he has a personal relationship. And I think Trump wants to send a message, the same message that he sent with the Scooter Libby pardon, which is, I will pardon you. I will pardon people. I have this power. Scooter Libby, Fitzgerald was fairly annoyed by the pardon of Scooter Libby,
sure,
and made a statement that's uncharacteristic of him to say anything about that kind of stuff. But, you know, Scooter Libby was a liar and a leaker, and he was convicted, and Trump just said, you know, so anyone else who wants to lie and leak, maybe I'll pardon you too.
But Trump loves leaks if this Russian tape
is true. By the way, I have to correct myself. In 2011, Blagojevich was sentenced to 14 years and began serving that term in 2012.
So it's been six years. Since he's gone in. Again, that seems like enough of a pound of flesh, given the other humiliations that he suffered and so on. Every time I post about this online or write about it, I get, you know, really strongly conflicting opinions from people, and it doesn't seem to be based on any partisanship. It's not like liberals feel one way, conservatives feel another.
But aren't you? I'm one guy, and I'm conflicted because I understand the importance of him not being able to spend any lifetime with his children. That's horrible. But I'm also of the belief that if you commit a crime, you pay the price.
And come on, you were the governor of Illinois,
right?
And you had the trust of the electorate, and you had this opportunity to, you know, do the right thing, and you didn't do it.
Yeah,
and that's a big betrayal. So
it's a huge betrayal.
So when you're talking about the, you know, it magnifies the offense when you have been elevated like that.
Yep, no question.
That kind of responsibility.
No question.
So it's a tough call.
That's Eric Zorn from the Chicago Tribune. We'll pick this up next. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200 is our number. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
We've got Eric Zorn in the studio with us.
Eric Zorn is here in the studio. Eric, we wanted to talk about what's going on with Starbucks. This is a crazy story.
Yeah, it's a crazy story. It was last Thursday in Philadelphia Starbucks. These two African-American men came in, and they were going to be meeting somebody there for coffee.
Yeah.
And they got there, they sat down, and they wouldn't leave. I guess somebody asked them to leave, maybe. I'm not exactly sure of the TikTok on this, but in any case, the manager of the store called the police, and the police came and arrested these guys. There were no charges were filed; they were released, and Starbucks has fired the manager who called 911 on them. But the question is not whether this is wrong and disturbing, as it clearly is. It clearly looks like these guys were profiled. People come into Starbucks and coffee shops all the time, and they're waiting for somebody, right? Or they're, you know, they want to use the bathroom.
People have that be their office.
People hang out at Starbucks. It's an interesting and kind of odd business model in a way. Like, there are a lot of places where I've been where you can get free Wi-Fi, but only for like half an hour, and then you got to go up to the desk to, you know, to the counter and
get a code.
And they discourage you from. I mean, they want it for customers. I understand that, but they don't want people to make it into their office. But the fact that they singled out these African American men really looks to me, to most people, like this was just racial profiling.
The charge here was loitering, or what?
I don't think they were charged at all. They were arrested and released. A lack of evidence that any kind of crime was committed. I mean, I suppose it would be trespassing or something if you are asked to leave a place of business and you don't leave.
Right.
And these guys apparently were not causing any disturbance at all. They were just sitting there, and they were in fact waiting for somebody who showed up, I guess, while they were being dragged out in handcuffs. People are justifiably outraged by this and concerned by it. But the question that comes up is, what does the customer do about it? What does the public do about it? There have been demonstrations outside the Starbucks, and so on. People have been calling for boycotts of Starbucks, and given that this is not something that you hear about all the time at Starbucks restaurants or coffee shops, and as far as I can tell, it's not a pattern. That this was more a problem with this one employee who overreacted.
This is a predominantly white neighborhood, is it?
I don't know the neighborhood, but the police, apparently the police chief has said that his guys were justified because they were called in to address the situation, and then it escalated, and they took them out. I don't know if people are that upset with the police here so much as they are with Starbucks. To my mind, Starbucks has been handling it as well as it can in the aftermath. It's a PR nightmare. You fire the manager.
They did.
And I think you need to restate or recreate your corporate policy about this stuff, under what situations can someone sit at a table in Starbucks? Under what situations can they use the restroom? All the kind of things that come up at these places that people come and hang out, and make as sure as you possibly can that these standards and principles are applied evenly for the races. Obviously,
of course,
if Starbucks reacts this way, and I assume that they are, then it seems like this is something that ought to pass as a reminder of this being a problem in our society, but not something that causes us to stop going to Starbucks or to make any more of it than it is.
Yeah.
But it's with these kind of instances, very interesting situation, and a lot of people have a lot of different opinions about it.
So they did fire the man. I don't know that the manager was the one who initiated a call to police.
I think it was the manager. I think it was the one who called 911. Yeah. And they've been relieved of their duties. Yeah. That seems like, what would you want a company to do in that situation other than to make sure it doesn't happen again and to discipline the employee who and this is all we know about it. It does bring up the sort of the larger question about people who use these places as their office, and they come in and they take tables. And I've certainly gone to some of these places sometimes to try to meet somebody for coffee.
And you can't.
And you can't sit down because there's all these people with their laptops.
I know.
But again, that's Starbucks' choice, right? Or Pete's, or any place you go like this. It's their choice to have this for people. And if that's their business model, then, there are certainly times where I've said, well, we probably shouldn't try to meet at Starbucks because we'll never get a seat. So,
Eric, there's an update that you can't possibly know because it's just happened in the last 10 or 15 minutes. But the CEO of Starbucks says that they hope to meet with the men that were arrested in the shop in Philadelphia and hopefully make things right.
Give them a gift card.
I wonder, you don't want to insult them by saying we hope to win you back over with a gift card,
they should.
Invariably, that's going to happen.
This is crisis management, right? You don't defend yourself on something like that. You say this was unacceptable to us,
right?
And we apologize without reservation.
How do you without insulting them further, how do you make this up? Is there a dollar amount you can do to so everybody goes, yeah, that seems fair? Or is it too much of an insult to even say that?
I imagine that the lawyers might be talking at this point. Yeah, I don't know that these men, I don't know that these men have come out in public, and I don't know, you know, what they will. I don't know what kind of legal case they would have. Except, yeah. I mean, this looks bad. I don't know that it violates any laws, any civil rights. It would be a very complicated case. You might actually see them offering some sort of a settlement to these guys before any lawsuits are filed. Like, can we put this behind us?
They should.
Kevin Johnson, the CEO of Starbucks, was on Good Morning America earlier this morning. Called what happened, the arrest, reprehensible. And hopes to meet with the men as soon as possible.
Yeah, I mean, that's
so that's what you do.
This is the resolution. This is, yeah, these, yeah. Too many companies, you know, fight back, try to justify what happened. They say, no, right. This is not our policy. We apologize.
We screwed up.
Yeah, I mean, just throw yourself on the mercy of the court of public opinion, which seems like the right thing to do.
Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Eric Zorn. You can read him in the Chicago Tribune. He does a fine, fine job there. We'll find out what Steve Bertrand has on the Wintrust Business Lunch next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.